So we wrapped OSA's policy engine as a concern for intercom developers and gave teams a simple API that was required for use across all controllers, but which was capable of both the traditional role-based and then the new attribute-based access control functionality that the developers were asking for.
Hi, you're listening to The Secure Developer. It's part of the DevSecOn community, a platform for developers, operators, and security people to share their views and practices on DevSecOps, Dev and Sec collaboration, cloud security, and more. Check out devsecon.com to join the community and find other great resources. This podcast is sponsored by Sneak. Sneak's developer security platform helps developers build secure applications without slowing down. Fixing vulnerabilities in code, open source, containers, and infrastructure as code. To learn more, visit sneak.io/TSD. That's SNYK.io/TSD. On today's episode, Guy Pajani, founder of Sneak, talks to Patrick Doherty, engineer at OSO. Patrick is a senior security engineer with a decade of experience developing, securing, and orchestrating software at scale. He has a background in security engineering, infrastructure security, full-stack product engineering, cloud architecture, and early-stage SaaS business growth and development. Patrick enjoys employing his product engineering background in a combination with security expertise to solve real-world problems with high quality of life software. We hope you enjoy their conversation, and don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes if you enjoyed today's episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Secure Developer. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about security solutions and maybe how that differs or is similar to security engineer and how that maybe differs from engineering in the first place, and in general, about all sorts of journeys within the security world. And to dig into all of those, we have with us Patrick O'Doherty, who is an engineer at OSO today. We'll hear about that a little bit more in a sec, and was previously a senior security engineer at Intercom, which we'll hear some stories from that part as well. Patrick, thanks for coming on to the show.
That's great to be here. Really excited.
So Patrick, before we dig in a little bit, I'll ask you to, can you just tell us a little bit about what is it that you do today and maybe a little bit about the journey that led there? You know, notably, we're going to dig into the intercom part, but maybe just in passing.
Yeah, so I'm a software engineer today at OSO, but in a prior life, I was a senior security engineer at Intercom. And I actually started at Intercom. I started about a decade ago in product engineering. I arrived at security by way of interest and I guess just being excited about the problems that there were to solve internally at Intercom and, you know, taking those opportunities when they were afforded me. But yeah, about a decade ago, I started in just what I call product engineering. So, you know, I was building web-based SaaS products for people. I joined Intercom actually. My first role was working on what was an early growth team. So basically focusing on the problem of helping people who are potential prospects, you know, understand all that Intercom had to offer, go from being a, you know, somebody on the website who has a curiosity all the way through the sign up, onboarding flows, educational flows, all the way through to being a happy paying customer. And yeah, over the years, I took on a couple of other different roles. Most notably after that was working on Intercom's billing infrastructure. And through that, I became a little bit more exposed to some of the security challenges of operating infrastructure for an organization that was growing. And then from there, I had a really well-timed opportunity to help the security team in Intercom as they were starting, when they were spun out from an infrastructure-only focus team. I spent a couple of months in Dublin helping some new security hires onboard, and it was a great trade. I was a local sort of subject matter expert on Intercom systems, but I wasn't very well-versed in security. My colleagues were very well-versed in security, but needed some help navigating Intercom and learning about all the where the skeletons were. And it was at that point that I realized, oh, wow, this is actually what I want to be doing as a career, you know, using the product engineering chops that I developed, but on a more focused set of problems, helping, you know, build what we called secure building blocks within Intercom that solved, you know, common problems for people to allow, you know, all the other developers to build with confidence, right? Without fear that, you know, they would introduce a significant vulnerability or, you know, set a cable wrong, something like that. So yeah, it was a natural progression of falling further and further down the rabbit hole of computer security and being offered opportunities to be responsible for it, which I was all too happy to take.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a really interesting kind of path there from growth to the billing side to the security side, and somewhat unusual maybe a transition of areas. I guess if you think about the skills that you have in the different stages there, even within the Intercom journey, do you think those are transferable? I mean, are the things that you've built up or knowledge you've built up, knowing how to do growth well, did they apply when you came along to work on security?
I think they were definitely helpful with respect to, you know, considering how you were going to ship tools to an internal audience, how to onboard people, you know, the considerations of their daily workflow and how you're going to be augmenting that. You know, I really think that security engineering is no different to product engineering insofar as you really have to understand the job that people are attempting to accomplish, you know, their priorities, things that are important to them, and then mix in sort of the security imperatives. Most people, when they ask you to, you know, for example, turn off a CSP component, your security mind will immediately jump to the red flags. But beneath the surface, there's actually a feature or some sort of product outcome that they're shooting for. And, you know, if you can dig and scratch and sort of build a better understanding of what the, you know, your counterparty is trying to do on the other side of the table, and, you know, use your security sort of knowledge to be able to make that a little bit safer, you can arrive at a result that both does the job, but also, you know, makes it safer for everybody. And I think that's really the fruitful sort of center of security and product engineering, is when you can sort of bring your knowledge of what your developer counterparts are trying to do and, you know, what's going to be important to them, how they're hoping to solve a problem, you know, what the onboard considerations are going to be, and mix that with, you know, all of the security imperatives that need to be true and arrive at a fruitful solution.
Yeah. So I love that. It's like the true platform mindset, you know, when you think about security, like security engineering as, you know, building a product for people. And you're also kind of throwing in the empathy angle of it, of how you're able to relate to maybe people that were in the position or working today on something you might have been working on before. So this is your journey and kind of your path. We're going to get a little bit to the last phase here of moving to software development within OSSO. And just for full disclosure for the listeners, I'm an investor in OSSO, which is actually how I managed to get to meet Patrick. So most of our conversation here is about his work at Intercom. But just for full disclosure, it's worth noting that. So through your journey here on, you know, we talked about sort of the growth, you know, to security and how that's similar. That's a bit specific to that engineering or the other. How would you say security engineering is different? You know, like if those previous bits are where it helps, what do you think were the most surprising bits around how security engineering differs from product?
I think the most challenging aspect of security engineering is possibly the fact that the field is constantly evolving. I think with respect to product engineering, there can be an idea that maybe something is complete or done. Whereas in security, if there's a new threat that is relevant to your domain, it's sort of on you to accommodate, you know, your existing tools and make sure that they are resilient against that threat. It was actually one of the things that I think made it one of the more exciting sort of career turns for me. You're constantly having to integrate, you know, new views of the world, new things that are happening into your threat model. And I think that that can be a challenge sometimes if you are not sort of used to having to constantly develop, you know, different sets of requirements. You know, you're sort of reading from sort of a product vision of what you want to build, and it's more cast in stone and less fluid. I think it can be challenging sometimes to sort of have the proper integration of what really needs to be true in the product world, while also being mindful of, you know, what's safe and possible and, you know, what the limits of the technology that you're using are. I think, yeah, being accurate about that can sometimes be a little bit difficult.
Does that align well with the general desire for agility? Because, I mean, I think the vision might be a bit less fluid, you know, hopefully, if you know what you're building towards in product engineering. But oftentimes today, the practice of building the software actually increasingly wants to be agile, wants to be able to zig and zag. I guess, do you find that to be similar to the need when new threats pop up, or do you feel it's apples and oranges?
Well, I certainly think that security engineering requires us to be more, you know, defensive in our thinking. You know, when we're considering a solution and we're building something in the product world, we'll often think of only the sort of the positive path, the intended virtuous path that a user might take through using a particular piece of the service. And I think security engineering calls on us to like really consider each facet of that in a more, exacting manner. Like what happens if users, abuse a component? Are there ways for, are there ways for a concerted and resourceful actor to use your product in a malicious way? I think it can be difficult sometimes for product engineers to, without previous experience of having something of theirs attacked, I think it can be difficult for them to envision the whole host of what happens in the full, the full internet coming to bear on their solution. And I think, security engineering, it's our job to look at what product engineers are doing and draw a pretty hard line around the safe elements and make sure that those things can be done safely. If you want to render content from an arbitrary source, that there are ways to do that safely without introducing a foot gun that's going to imperil your product later. And I think that can be, I think that's really describing the biggest difference is that, with product engineering, you're very focused on sort of the virtuous path, the positive feedback loop that you want people to have with your the service, the feature that you're building. And with security engineering, you're basically working backwards. You're sort of asking 100 questions as to what happens when users don't complete this flow and they enter somebody else's email or they attempt to use a resource that they don't own. And I think that those, having a view as to what are the most important boundaries to establish for your developers and your company, I think is really the most important element. Like it's having a knowledge of the strategic problems of importance to your organization, and it'll be different for every organization. It'll be based on the inputs and outputs. Are you taking in arbitrary content from people? That's probably dangerous. You should do something about that. You should put sandboxes around that. You should make sure that it's safe to handle for your product engineers. And it's, it's our job as security engineers to make sure that, we're giving people safe power tools.
Yeah. I love that. You've kind of just embodied basically the complexity of being a security engineer, which is on one hand, you need to be agile and adapt to sort of threats as they pop in. You can't get too enamored with your roadmap and your path because new things will pop up and like it or not, you need to adapt. At the same time, you don't have the benefit of, hey, I'll just do this piece over here and I'll move on. Oftentimes you need, probably never perfection, but more thoroughness in your activity than you might be allowed on the product side. So Patrick, through this journey, the team, I know from our previous chat, the team that you landed on in Intercom, it's called Security Solutions, which I found to be an interesting name for a security team. What was the charter of that team and what type of work did you do or what did you own?
Yeah, so Security Solutions was an internal team of engineers who built common infrastructure and coding patterns for use throughout Intercom. So everything from designing and implementing the authorization layer that sits atop, customer interactions with their conversation data through to one recent project that I worked on before I left was introducing a safe rendering library. So Intercom is a communications platform. It takes in large amounts of rich content from a multitude of sources, and it needs to be rendered securely in a workflow application where people are responding to customer inquiries. And so we would basically look at what are the, the most important assets that Intercom has, what are the sort of the most dangerous tasks that product engineers and other parts of the business are taking on a daily basis, and try and build like solid tooling for that, really to introduce common components and pieces of infrastructure, libraries and other resources that people could use to go about their day safely without having to be mindful or, to have a full sort of expert knowledge of the relevant security risks.
I think that's a super capable team. I guess the oftentimes falls under one of the mantles of product security. How did the Security Solutions team interact with the rest of the engineering organization, right? Or with other people building maybe other shared components like platform or infrastructure?
So I often described Security Solutions as sort of an internal consulting team for all of the rest of Intercom. And we had a program of security champions, so people who would volunteer from different product teams or elsewhere who had a mind for security and who would often sort of raise novel issues with us or things that their teams were experiencing or having issues with and bring them to us. So oftentimes it was either through either internal consulting or, we had a number of security program sort of metrics overall that we would be responsible for throughout the organization. And so interactions were either, you know, sourced from problems that people were having, which thankfully as a team of builders, you know, we had a strong relationship with the other developers around Intercom. We weren't seen as a blocker. We were seen as a team that would be able to work with you to develop a solution and like build something better, which I think is extremely important. If you're viewed as a naysayer or a drag on product development, you will often not have a full view of all of the problems that are relevant to your organization. I think it's really important to maintain a healthy set of, you can't defend what you don't know, and you need people to tell you what to defend. So it's one of those like at the bottom of the pyramid of requirements. And otherwise, you know, we were responsible for, you know, the overall measurement and, you know, ongoing sort of monitoring of our security health. So if there was issues that we could spot in the future from bug crowd reports or other sorts of leading indicators, we would work with teams and reach out to them and say like, hey, we think that this might be an area of difficulty. What do you think? We have a solution in mind. You know, here's a prototype of it. We think that this would be relevant for X, Y, and Z. What do you say? So yeah, always with a friendly hand, I guess, is the better answer of how do interactions start, either from a problem that was sourced from, you know, felt pain from one of our security champions or something that we could see in the numbers, but always with a proposed solution in hand.
Yeah, no, I love that approach. And many of these things are in the security solutions team, but was the team, just sort of geeking out a little bit about org responsibilities, was the team itself also in charge of handling the incoming bug bounties and such, or was that another security team? You were just looking for patterns and building things out.
So we have a sibling team, threat detection, who were, I would say, like more in charge of the operational day-to-day aspects of running our security program. So, you know, an example piece of infrastructure that security solutions and threat detection would have collaborated on was the scanning of uploads and attachments from all sorts of media sources that would arrive into Intercom. You know, we built this as a component and managing the health of Intercom in response to malicious uploads or, you know, email reputation or other concerns relating to how malicious actors might take advantage of the platform was more of a operational concern that would have been run by threat detection, but they would have, you know, big issues would have been collaborated on by both teams. You know, if there's a leading, if we see an uptick in the metrics on one side, it would definitely be a shared problem and collaboration for both sides. You know, we want to build solutions that are easy to run, that, you know, reduce toil, that, you know, are respective of people's time and the job that they're trying to do. And so we were very, very incentivized to make the lives of our threat detection colleagues as easy as possible with the solutions that we were building.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the helpful approach on both fronts, not just to the engineers, but also to the ones dealing with the risk itself. So let's go down a level and actually get to some concrete examples. So what are some examples of some projects that you were working on, solutions you were building, I guess, as part of the security solutions mandate?
The two projects that I worked on most recently before I departed Intercom were on a secure rendering solution. So something that I alluded to earlier. And this was a project, and the second one was relating to platform authorization. So overhauling how the authorization layer for people accessing their conversations, their workflows, and other aspects of their data, how that was available as a API to product developers. So the first secure rendering solution, this was something that I, you know, based on a year-end evaluation of our bug crowd program, we had noticed a slight uptick in the number of CSP failures. So one of the things I was always very proud of at Intercom was that we maintained a very tight and exacting content security policy for the primary web application. So it's where Intercom users would log in every day to visit the inbox, to, you know, respond to customer inquiries, to create their email campaigns, whatever it may be, to view customer profiles. This application contains a huge amount of very sensitive data. You know, it's your business conversations, it's your customer profiles. And we had for a very long time maintained that CSP should be as tight as possible and that we would treat any CSP escape as, even if it was blocked by the browser, we would treat any sort of CSP failure as a very high priority. And in the latter half of 2020, we noticed that there had been sort of an uptick in the number of CSP escapes that we were having reported in via bug crowd. And having looked at this, we realized that there was a number of different rendering jobs being performed across the Intercom app with mixed views of content, and that we could do a better job of sort of limiting those jobs, limiting the rendering tasks to only sort of secure versions of that. At the center of this, there's what Intercom called its blocked content. So all of the rich media that makes its way into Intercom, emails, conversations, was serialized in what was called a block format, which contained a very, very small subset of HTML for, you know, basically text markup, you know, bolding, italicized. And it also allowed for the rich rendering of, or the embedding of certain supported media. So things like YouTube videos or other content that you would want to be able to put into a conversation and have rendered securely. And we realized that, you know, basically this block's content, its subset of HTML was sort of the set that we wanted to be allowed across all of Intercom. And so we decided that we would sort of turn it inside out. We would take what was a small HTML sanitization layer that was embedded in blocks and make it sort of the universal rendering output across all of the applications. So in looking at the problem, we realized that there was only three types of rendering jobs that were happening in Intercom. There was render a full set of blocks with all of the rich content that that entailed, or there was what was really the crux of the problem was rendering this very limited set of HTML elsewhere. So things like, you know, if you wanted to add a note to a user profile with some bolding or italicized, there were some small air gaps in that that would allow content that you didn't want to get in there and then eventually be knocked back by the CSP. But we just didn't want to deal with that anymore. And so we had a look and we realized that we could do away with all of the unsecure rendering practices that people had been using DOM syncs and instead replace it with this HTML sanitization layer, which we had already implemented for our messenger. And so having reduced it to those three things, we basically outlawed all the other use of dangerous HTML paths and successfully managed to lint away from them.
Great kind of a end-to-end story and the different components within it. I'm interested at the sort of the bit about going on the developer education story. So it sounds like, you know, you've done all this analysis. I imagine you worked with the teams ahead of time to understand the needs, understand the components, and yet you needed that, I guess, campaign later on for them to change it. Was that hard? Was it a risk in the process that you will do all this work and you would build all this stuff and the teams wouldn't actually adopt it? Or did you get buy-in ahead of time?
I never appreciated that it would be a risk in getting it shipped, I have to say. But we had a lot of buy-in from people who wanted to see this problem solved. You know, for each of the teams, they would have been previously responsible for following up with the bug crowd reports or the issues that would have come to them. So there was a, you know, alignment of incentives here that they just wanted to be done with this as a problem. And in fact, you know, some of the issues that were at play, like the teams felt like that they didn't necessarily have, you know, 100% confidence in their solution to mitigate, you know, all the dangerous possibilities of rendering. And so I think actually the level of issues that we were experiencing was such that people were very, very happy to see a solution. And so we also went about by automating and giving like exacting input to each team using some of the, through Intercom there's a pattern of every substantial piece of code is attributed back to the team that owns it. And we were able to programmatically use this data to GitHub issues that would tell a team exactly what they needed to do, where and what. You know, here's an example PR of how this other team has successfully migrated this, you know, and by demonstrating that there wasn't a huge effort, you know, that it was really a couple of simple substitutions and the problem would be solved one and done. I think that was enough really for people to see that it was worthwhile doing. And, you know, once we had a couple of teams take it on very quickly and, you know, everybody was able to watch the progress of this large GitHub milestone close up to 100%. So it was really a team-led affair for sure.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of mutual sort of incentives aligning, I guess, to make it go so well.
Interesting. I love the, it's still a service mentality and it's still a campaign. So you're going into it, you have a certain amount of buy-in already from people that make you think this is a kind of a reasonable risk to take or a worthy enough investment of not insubstantial amount of engineering time probably to build these new components. And then you go off and promote, but I guess back to that growth experience maybe from earlier on, think about onboarding, think about sort of ease of use and ease of implementation because you still need to get people to buy into the journey, appreciating the pain that you're addressing, you know, for instance, that lack of confidence in it. So a lot of narratives that would apply to building any dev tool or the likes, because that's really what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And we put a fair amount of effort into, you know, documenting the background of the problem, the pain that was being felt, you know, highlighting to people the significance of what happens when this goes wrong, you know, and really why it's important to have it be correct. I'm often mindful that, you know, solving a problem for a team is kind of the best solution, especially, or is the best case because they're probably familiar with the pain point previously. You know, so they have this contrasting view of before and after, where I think it's really hard is, you know, solving a problem for a team of folks who have yet to be hired or, you know, like the engineers who are going to arrive 12 to 18 months down the line. Like, how do you ensure that they through no fault of their own, like don't accidentally veer out of the, you know, the blessed set of solutions. And I think a heavy reliance on automation and documentation there was like really what made it work for us. You know, we were able to say, you know, this is the chosen solution, and we will, through aggressive code linting and early feedback loops in your test suite, make it known to you when, you know, you're doing something that might be dangerous, and we'll suggest this solution that we have in hand as an alternative.
Yeah, so perfect.
Yeah, making it easy for people to become aware when they were, you know, walking off the blessed path was also a big part of making it successful.
Awesome. So maybe we sort of squeeze one more in here. So tell us about the other project. And was in a different domain there of authorization you mentioned. What was that one about?
So yeah, authorization again was something that it was something that we had started to see in like a small background radiation bug crowd numbers creeping up. So it was actually the initial authorization solution was one that I had built with some colleagues many years ago. And, you know, it's a success when something that you built 3 years ago, you outgrow it, you outscale it, you know, the needs of the organization, the needs of your product become more complex. And we had a relatively rudimentary access control layer that was implemented at all the controller levels across Intercom that basically implemented role-based access control for all of the different data types and other things that you would want to protect. And this solution had been built in a time where it was viewed as sort of like an opt-in mechanism. So, you know, if you were a member of an Intercom workspace, you generally had access to a lot of things. And in fact, you know, by the time this work came around, that sort of presumption had been inverted. And, you know, we wanted to introduce a world where, you know, being a mere member of a workspace wasn't a guarantee enough to get further access. We wanted to be able to describe more granular access layers and have confidence that this authorization would be uniformly enforced. And in addition, we had a product team reach out to us and say, hey, you know, we want to start introducing attribute-based access control, an entirely new form of how Intercom was viewing permissions and which sort of operated, you know, entirely orthogonal to the previous solution. So where previously we had a controller level concern, we now wanted to be able to ask, you know, authorization questions about any given object in a request and determine a user's access to it independent of the outer HTTP request and the controller that they were talking to. And this just absolutely seemed ripe for a security solutions implementation. It's every piece of the product engineers are working on is guarded by some form of authorization. And so it was, you know, part of everyday practice and everyday work for them. And if we could make it better, there would be multiplicative benefits along the line. And so we had the benefit also of working in a monolith code base where, you know, we could rely very heavily on convention and, you know, like creating one sort of chosen way of doing something and use a number of code base linting or custom sort of coding specs to make sure that it was enforced. And so ended up settling on a hybrid solution, I guess, where this is how I actually became aware of OSA, was using this for, or using their products to implement Intercom's authorization layer.
By them up motion in action there.
Yeah, I was very, very happy for their existence when I was building this. And so we wrapped OSA's policy engine as a concern for Intercom developers and gave teams a simple API that was required for use across all controllers, but which was capable of both the traditional role-based and then the new attribute-based access control functionality that the developers were asking for. And the big sort of, I guess, trick of this implementation was that we, as security solutions, we didn't want to be in the middle of product engineering work. You know, it doesn't matter to us what role gives access to what resource. What we care about is that the actual authorization policy, like the logic that's being enforced, was uniform, that it was sound, and that, you know, there wasn't any possibility for, you know, product engineers to accidentally create a, you know, an unauthorized branch of this policy. And so we ended up using OSO in combination with some code owners' GitHub practices to basically separate logic and data, where, you know, security solutions became responsible for the logic of the policy, you know, the definition of users, the definition of workspaces, the relationship to each other, how that is sort of hydrated in the course of a HTTP request or any internal authorization query. But we left the definition of roles and what they gave access to entirely up to product engineers as it was before. And so in that way, you know, basically every new piece of code had to be added to this policy data layer, which we didn't have sort of we didn't enforce code owners' restrictions over, but the policy bits, you know, if people wanted to make a product or an authorization logic change, and that was something where they would, through code owners, have like get code review from security solutions, and this part of the code base which would change at a much, much, much lower rate was, you know, kept safe and sound while the policy data bit was left available to product engineers to change as they saw fit, which was, you know, a very, very common occurrence. As they're building up new controllers, new concerns, we wanted that to be something that they could just add to on a daily basis without any risk of, you know, introducing invariants that they didn't like.
Yeah. So in this case, it's very much a platform engineering type of work. So you embedded this, unlike the previous example where you had to go champion and get the different dev teams to opt in. This was a central decision that team got, whether they liked it or not, right? It was a bit of a broad rollout. Is that correct?
Yeah. And we had the benefit of, I guess, a solution already being in place. So we used GitHub's scientist code to demonstrate to people that the OSO-based solution that we were running was 100% ounce for ounce equivalent in terms of the results that it would produce, but that it would, you know, provide all these sort of ergonomic benefits that they wouldn't have to manage the policy bit. They wouldn't have to manage any of the sort of operational concerns. There would be a simple registry of, you know, roles and resources and other components that would be, you know, their day-to-day domain, safe and sound, that all of the other bits of the machinery were operating as expected. And so being able to show the equivalency of these results was a huge, you know, advantage. It allowed us to, you know, roll this out without any sort of doubt in the back of our mind that we were going to, you know,
successfully get it adopted. Yeah.
Yeah. And also that we were, you know, it's authorization, you know, it's effectively the essence of your application, right? Who can do what? It's so core to any product that you're going to develop. You know, we didn't want to be, I guess, cavalier with making large changes to such a crucial bit of the code that was, you know, running atop every single request, and where mistakes would effectively mean, you know, a privacy incident or, you know, a data leak incident. And so the ability to, you know, safely experiment to show, you know, to, I guess, like validate against our production traffic and over time build confidence in that solution and then flip out the authoritative side of the equation was a huge win. You know, it allowed us and the product engineers both to have complete confidence that, you know, everything was going to work as we would expect.
Yeah, no, it sounds awesome. And it's interesting to sort of hear about the two projects in contrast, you know, each of those tackling different, this one a bit more preemptive and a bit more platform minded versus the previous example, which was more dealing with maybe some ongoing leakage, you know, of another issue coming along and in a component. So thanks, Patrick. This was super interesting. You know, sort of feels like this, you know, day in the life of a security engineer from the sort of the empathy aspects of, you know, journey into it and how it differs from engineering into these last two kind of concrete examples of solutions and how they interacted with the engineering team. So thanks for that walkthrough. But before I let you go, I want to ask you my one kind of regular open-ended question towards the end of it. And here it is. So if you had an unlimited amount of resources, funding to tackle a problem that is, you know, related to your world, what problem would you take on? And if you know, maybe which approach would you take on to tackle it?
When I think of all of the most challenging security problems I've had to deal with, they have related to the use of third-party vendors and like integrations within to your application or your service. I think I would challenge people to have a threat model relating to every integration, every piece of infrastructure, every component that they add, which is operated by a third party, and consider risk mitigations for that. You know, if you're operating a piece of infrastructure on-prem in your cloud environment, that maybe you should put sufficient guardrails around that if ever there is a need to contain it. It's, you know, being very exacting about the permissions and the authorization grants you give to third parties, auditing them on a timely basis, and really knowing sort of the ins and outs, the inputs and outputs of your organization. I think going back to something that I said earlier, you can't secure what you don't know. And I think most organizations would be surprised at the level of access they have maybe granted to third parties and the risk exposure that is there. We're all in this together, you know, so it's appropriate to consider the every vendor, every link in the chain, both for yourself, but also onward interactions with your position in other people's supply chains.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, not an easy one. Definitely sort of a worthy one to take on it. Patrick, thanks again for all the insights and for coming on to the show.
Oh, it's been great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks everyone for tuning in, and I hope you join us for the next one.
Thanks for listening to The Secure Developer. That's all we have time for today. To find additional episodes and full transcriptions, visit thesecuredeveloper.com. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or get involved in the community, find us on Twitter at DevSecCon. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes if you enjoyed today's episode. Bye for now.